My friend Hugh Granger and I had just returned from a 2 days' visit in the country, where we'd been staying in a house which was supposed to be haunted by ghosts of a peculiarly fearsome and truculent sort. "Why you go ghost-seeking, I can't imagine," Hugh said, "because your teeth were chattering and your eyes starting out of your head all the time you were there. Or do you like being frightened?" "Why, of course I like being frightened," I said. "Fear is the most absorbing and luxurious of emotions. One forgets all else if one's afraid."
"Well, the fact that neither of us saw anything," he said, "confirms what I've always believed."
"And what have you always believed?" I asked.
"That these phenomena are purely objective, and that one's state of mind has nothing to do with perceiving them. Look at Osberton, where we've been staying. It's had the reputation of being a haunted house for years, and it certainly has all the accessories of one. Look at yourself, too, with all your nerves on edge. Surely there was the right man in the right place then, if ghosts are subjective."
He got up and lit a cigarette, and looking at him, Hugh is about 6 feet high and as broad as he is long, I felt a retort on my lips, for I couldn't help my mind going back to a certain period in his life when, for some cause which, as far as I knew, he had never told anybody, he had become a mere quivering mass of disordered nerves. Oddly enough, at that very same moment, and for the first time, he began to speak of it himself.
"You may reply that it wasn't worth my while going to Osberton either," he said, "because I was so clearly the wrong man in the wrong place. But I wasn't. You, for all your apprehensions, have never seen a ghost. But I have. Though I'm the last person in the world you would have thought likely to do so. And it knocked me all to bits at the time."
He sat down again in his chair. "I want first to tell you quite shortly my theory about ghost-seeing," he continued. "And I can explain it best by a simile, an image. Imagine, then, that you and I, and everybody in the world, are like people whose eyes directly opposite a tiny hole in a sheet of cardboard, which is continually shifting and moving about. Back to back with that sheet of cardboard is another, which also, by laws of its own, is in perpetual but independent motion. In it, too, there is another hole, and when these two holes, the one through which we are always looking, and the other in the spiritual plane, come opposite one another, we see through. And then the sights and sounds of the spiritual world become visible or audible to us. Now, in some natures," he went on, "these holes are comparatively large and are constantly coming into opposition. Clairvoyants, mediums are like that. But I'm the sort of person who long ago made up his mind that he would never see a ghost. It was an incalculable chance that my spy hole should come into opposition with the other. But it did, and it knocked me out of time." "I hope your ghost was more original than your theory," I said, in order to bring him to the point.
"Yes, I think it was. You shall judge."
I put on more coal and poked up the fire.
"It was the 24th of June, 18 months ago," he said. "I'd left my flat, you may remember, and came up here from the country to stay with you for a week. We had dined alone here."
Did you see the ghost here?" I asked. "In this square little box of a house in a modern street?"
"I was in the house when I saw it," he said. "We had dined alone here in Graham Street, and after dinner I went out to some party and you stopped at home. At dinner, your man didn't wait, and when I asked where he was, you told me he was ill, and, I thought, changed the subject rather abruptly. You gave me your latchkey when I went out, and on coming back I found you'd gone to bed. There were, however, several letters for me which required answers. I wrote them there and then and posted them in the pillar box opposite. So I suppose it was rather late when I went upstairs. You'd put me in the front room on the third floor overlooking the street. It was a very hot night, and I was feeling sleepy and heavy. It wasn't till after I got into bed that I noticed by the shadows of the window frames on the blind that only one of the windows was open. But it didn't seem worthwhile to get out of bed in order to open it, though I felt airless and uncomfortable, and I went to sleep. What time it was when I awoke, I don't know. But it was certainly not yet dawn, and I never remembered being conscious of such an extraordinary stillness as prevailed. There was no sound of foot passengers or wheeled traffic. The music of life appeared to be absolutely mute. But now, instead of being sleepy and heavy, I felt perfectly fresh and wide awake, and the effort which had not seemed worth making before, that of getting out of bed and opening the other window, was quite easy. I pulled up the blind threw it wide open, and leaned out.
Even outside, the oppression was very noticeable, and though I'm not easily given to feel the mental effects of climate, I was aware of a sort of creepiness coming over me. I felt, too, dreadfully lonely in this stillness before the dawn. Then I heard suddenly, and not very far away, the sound of some approaching vehicle. I could distinguish the tread of two horses walking at a slow pace. They were, though yet invisible, coming up the street. And yet this indication of life didn't abate my dreadful sense of loneliness. Then the vehicle came into sight. At first I couldn't distinguish what it was. Then I saw that the horses were black and had long tails, and that what they dragged was made of glass, but had a black frame. It was a hearse. Empty. It was moving up this side of the street. It stopped at the door of this house. Then the obvious solution struck me. You said at dinner that your manservant was ill, and you were, I thought, unwilling to speak about his illness. No doubt, so I imagined now he was dead, and for some reason, perhaps because you didn't want me to know anything about it, you were having the body removed at night. This, I must tell you, passed through my mind quite instantaneously, and it didn't occur to me how unlikely it really was. I was still leaning out of the window, and I remember wondering how odd it was that every detail of the hearse was visible. There was only one man, the driver, with it, and the street was otherwise absolutely empty. It was at him I was looking now. I could see every detail of his clothes. But from where I was, so high above him, I couldn't see his face. Over his shoulder there was a strap, which seemed to support some sort of little bag. He looked exactly like... Well, from my description, what did he look exactly like? Why, a bus conductor, I said instantly. So I thought, and even while I was thinking this, he looked up at me. He had a long, thin face, and on his left cheek there was a mole. All this was as distinct as if it had been noonday, and as if I were within a yard of him. Then he touched his hat to me, and jerked his thumb over his shoulder.
"Room for one more inside, sir," he said.
There was something so odious, so coarse, so unfeeling about this, that I instantly drew my head in, pulled the blind down again, and turned on the electric light to see what time it was. The hands of my watch pointed to 11:30. It was then for the first time, I think, that a doubt crossed my mind as to the nature of what I had just seen. But I put out the light again and got into bed. There was stillness again. I expected every moment to hear muffled footsteps on the stairs, footsteps moving slowly and smallly under the weight of a heavy burden. But from inside the house there was no sound whatever. Outside, too, in the street, there was the same dead silence, while the hearse waited at the door. And the minutes ticked on, and at length I began to see a difference in the light in the room, and knew that the dawn was beginning to break outside. But how had it happened, then, that if the corpse was to be removed at night, it had not gone, and that the hearse still waited, when morning was already coming? I got out of bed, went to the window, and pulled back the blind. The dawn was coming fast. The whole street was lit by that silver, hueless light of morning. But there was no hearse there. Once again I looked at my watch. It was just 4:15. But I would swear that not half an hour had passed since it had told me that it was 11:30. Then a curious double sense, as if I was living in the present and at the same moment had been living in some other time, came over me. It was dawn on 25th, and the street, as natural, was empty. But a little while ago, the driver of a hearse had spoken to me, and it was 11:30. What was that driver? To what plane did he belong? And then I told myself that the whole thing had been a dream. But if you asked me whether I believed what I told myself, I must confess that I did not. Your man didn't appear at breakfast next morning, nor did I see him again before I left that afternoon. I think if I had, I should have told you all about this. But it was still possible, you see, that what I had seen was a real hearse, driven by a real driver, for all the ghastly gaiety of the face that had looked up to mine, and the levity of his pointing hand.
I might possibly have fallen asleep soon after seeing him, and slumbered through the removal of the body and the departure of the hearse, so I didn't speak of it to you.
There was something straightforward and prosaic in my friend Hugh's story, and somehow the very absence of suitable surroundings made the story more impressive. But for a moment, a doubt assailed me. "Don't tell me it was all a dream," I said.
"I don't know whether it was or not. I can only say that I believe myself to have been wide awake. And in any case, the rest of the story is odd." "I went out of town again that afternoon," he continued, "and I may say that I don't think that even for a moment did I get the haunting sense of what I had seen or dreamed that night out of my mind. It was present to me always as some vision unfulfilled. It was as if some clock had struck the four quarters, and I was still waiting to hear what the hour would be." Exactly a month afterwards, I was in London again, but only for the day. I arrived at Victoria about 11 and took the underground to Sloane Square, in order to see if you were in town and would give me lunch. It was a baking hot morning, and I intended to take a bus from the King's Road as far as your place here in Graham Street. There was a bus standing at the corner just as I came out of the tube station, but I saw that the top was full and the inside appeared to be full also. Just as I came up to it, the conductor, who I suppose had been inside collecting fares, came out onto the step within a few feet of me. Over his shoulder was a strap on which hung his little machine for punching tickets. I saw his face, too. It was the face of the driver of the hearse, with a mole on the left cheek. Then he spoke to me, jerking his thumb over his shoulder.
"Room for one more inside, sir," he said.
At that, a sort of panic took possession of me, and I knew I gesticulated with my arms and cried, "No, no!" But at that moment I was living not in the hour that was then passing, but in that hour which had passed a month ago, when I leant from the window of your bedroom here just before the dawn broke. At this moment, too, I knew that my spy-hole had been opposite the spy-hole into the spiritual world. What I had seen there had some significance, now being fulfilled. And I stood there on the pavement, shaking and trembling. I was opposite the post office at the corner, and just as the bus started, my eye fell on the clock in the window there. I needn't tell you what the time was. 11:30.
Perhaps I needn't tell you the rest, since you may not have forgotten what happened at the corner of Sloane Square at the end of July, the summer before last. The bus pulled out from the pavement into the street, in order to get round a van that was standing in front of it. At that moment there came down the King's Road a big motor, going at a hideously dangerous pace. It crashed full into the bus, burrowing into it as a gimlet burrows into a board, and killing everyone. He paused. "And that's my story," he said.